Good afternoon. My name is Derek Douglas, and I'm the Special Assistant to President Obama for Urban Policy. We want to welcome you all today to join us for a live chat on sustainable communities, and I want to start by thanking Planetizen and its readers for partnering with us on this live chat. The Sustainable Communities Partnership is one of the central components of our urban policy agenda at the White House. We have with us today three of the leaders of the Sustainable Communities Partnership. To my immediate left is Shelley Poticia. She's the director of the Office of Sustainable Housing and Communities at HUD. Next to her is Beth Osborne, who is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy at the Department of Transportation. And next to Beth is Tim Torma, who is the Deputy Director of the Office of Sustainable Communities at EPA. If you've been following the work of this partnership, you'll know that they've really been taking some groundbreaking approaches to the way development happens in America. What we wanted to do today was to speak directly to you to address the questions you have about what the partnership is doing, what are its future plans, how can we make these changes permanent. And so what I'll be doing is reading questions that came in from the Planetizen readers, and then I'll be intermixing those with questions that come in through the website. If you're watching now and want to ask questions, you can do so at the White House Facebook page. The other thing I wanted to mention was that the response we got was really overwhelming. We had over 200 people ask questions that were submitted and over 2,000 votes on the questions that came in. What we did was take a sampling of some of the most popular questions, and those will be the ones that we'll address today. So I want to start with the question for Shelley. This question comes, Shelley, from Matt in Washington, D.C. The question is, what is being done to promote transit-oriented development that is also affordable? Matt points out that most local TOD apartments, condos, and townhomes are priced and advertised as luxury units, excluding many of the people who rely on transit the most. Shelley?
Well, that's a really terrific question, Matt, and it's exactly to the heart of what we're trying to accomplish through this partnership and one of the main reasons that the Department of Housing and Urban Development is engaged in this. Because we see that there are tremendous benefits for helping people reduce their time spent away from their homes, their families, reduce the amount of money they're spending on transportation by having good access to transportation options like walking, biking, and particularly taking transit, which connects to so many of our region's jobs. And yet in the last market run-up, the real estate market really focused extensively on clustering high-density housing near transit that ended up being mostly available to high-income households. At HUD, we're trying to promote income diversity in all of the investments that we make and try and help our policies recognize that when low and moderate income people live within walking distance of transit, not only are they more likely to use the transit system, but they get benefits by spending less on transportation expenditures like, you know, auto insurance, car repair, gas. So in our work, we have a new grant program out that we're actually doing in conjunction with the Department of Transportation. And one of the things that we're looking for are zoning codes that might help promote income diversity in neighborhoods near transit, either through inclusionary housing ordinances, new types of housing products that might be located in areas near transit, and proactive planning for housing preservation so that we can ensure that as we move forward, we're making options available for people of all incomes near transit. And that's really a very high priority for our agency.
I'd love to add that the very beginning of this partnership actually began about 2 years ago when the Federal Transit Agency and HUD came together to look at this exact issue. And they have been putting together guidance to local communities on how they can preserve affordable housing near transit sites. But one of the issues we run into is the demand for this kind of housing is so overwhelming and continues to increase. while the supply has not really responded, and that's due to any number of issues that I'm sure we'll talk about here today, but anytime you've got demand that is here and supply that is here, you set the price so high that only people with a lot of funding and a lot of choices can play in that market. And so one thing we can do is just provide more of it. And then we can get out of these cycles where just the rumor of a new transit line sends housing prices in that area through the roof.
Thank you. Tim, here's a question that came from Toby in Anniston, Alabama. For continuity and the shared understanding of sustainability, what is the best example to date of any state DOTs and EPA's collaboration on a sustainability-based project?
Okay, thanks, Toby. That's a good question. I think that it's really important for environmental agencies like the EPA, but those at the state level as well, to work with their counterparts and departments of transportation. There are some good examples that I'd like to tell you about where the federal EPA has worked with state DOTs. The one that comes most immediately to mind is that we worked with the Department of Transportation in the state of California to develop something called Smart Mobility 2010. And this is a tool that the state now uses to evaluate the greenhouse gas impacts of their transportation investments. Transportation contributes about one-third of all greenhouse gases, and the transportation sector uses about 70% of all of the petroleum that's used in this country. So it's important for environmental agencies and transportation agencies to work together to figure out how to reduce our dependence on oil, how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and do that in a way that makes smart investments and provides people with transportation choices. One other example, if I may, is the EPA also worked with the Virginia Department of Transportation recently. The problem that they faced and asked for our help and advice with was accepting streets into the state transportation system that were not well connected. That meant that everybody who got in their car had to go out on that arterial that we all hate to get on. It's the one that's always crowded and congested. And they wanted to know if there were ideas and ways that they might change their street standards to improve the streets, make them more connected, allow people to walk, and to reduce traffic congestion. We worked with them and they changed their policy on that. So there's another good example.
Terrific. This is a question that goes to the, is asking about a broader definition of affordability. It comes from Hermes in Tucson, Arizona, and I want to ask you, Beth, to address it first and then open it up. The question is, how are you currently analyzing the costs of our present communities as it relates to transportation, health, savings, and most importantly, livability? The hidden costs of our present way of living must be shown like our credit card debt.
Now, that's an excellent question, and not an easy issue to address, but really paramount that we do so. There are a few things going on to better capture the full costs of different types of development and transportation investments. One of the first steps we took is to get rid of the way we evaluate transit projects, which had previously just looked at the cost of the project versus travel time savings. And we are trying to capture the full benefits and the full costs of a project that includes air quality benefits, that includes economic benefits in the community where the transit will be built, and gets a much fuller sense of what the full costs and benefits are. There is an ANPRM, which is a group of letters I never thought I would use together before I came into government, and it means Advance Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. It has been published in the Federal Register, and we're accepting comments from practitioners and from communities about the best way to consider these benefits and these costs. And the comment period closes on August the 2nd, and then we will go forward with the full rulemaking process. And so there will be another round of opportunity for the public to engage. We also, with the Recovery Act, was given a pot of funding for multimodal investment. It was a competitive grant program. We call it TIGER. And it was $1.5 billion for multimodal investments. One of the things we requested from those who applied was a cost-benefit of their projects, and we asked for more than what we normally ask for in transportation, included a lot of these other costs. How will this investment save funds, not just within the transportation sector, but in terms of avoided infrastructure costs and those sorts of things? And frankly, just going through this procedure has allowed us to learn a little bit more about what the state of the art is across the country, what data is currently being collected, frankly, what data is not being collected, and where we need to do more work in those areas. A lot more work needs to go into fully estimating what the unintended costs of certain transportation investments are. If you lay out a road, what is the likelihood that you're going to spur new development that's going to require the federal government to invest in new water infrastructure, further road infrastructure, new housing? And we have not done enough to encourage agencies to look at the impacts of their program on other programs. And in fact, our budget process doesn't really do that. And so that's something that we're going to have to grapple with, but it is going to be extremely important in determining where the taxpayer will get the best bang for their buck. And particularly in a program like ours, that is running very short on cash these days, I think that that's paramount in terms of our responsibility to the American taxpayers. We're going back and asking for a reauthorization of our program.
Shelley and Tim, did you have anything to?
Well, the questioner mentioned health in particular among the things that that they feel like better cost accounting ought to be done for. And I think it is worth mentioning that in recent years, the public health community and researchers who do a lot of work on public health have really started to focus on and look at how the way we build our cities influences people's health in a lot of different ways. And I think the one that's most relevant to what we're talking about today is that research has shown consistently over the last several years that the built environment influences obesity in particular. And this is particularly important now. We know the First Lady has her initiative on reducing childhood obesity, and that over one third of kids are overweight right now. That is due in some part to how we build and design our communities. And that's something that this partnership is working on and trying to address.
Terrific. The next question comes from Eliza in Orlando, Florida. I'd actually like each of you to address this one. The question says, Secretary Donovan in a speech in Atlanta said that in the future, the entire budget of HUD can be geared towards building sustainable communities. Now the questioner asked specifically about DOT. Is DOT thinking the same way? And will we see a decrease in funding for damaging highway capacity projects? Now what I'd like for each of you to do is talk about, in response to this question, how are you applying these sustainable community principles beyond just the quote-unquote sustainable communities programs?
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I'll start with that since Secretary Donovan did mention this. I know, pushing the envelope. In connection with this same speech in Atlanta, Secretary Donovan announced that one of the criteria that will be used in most of our discretionary funding that runs through HUD will include sustainability principles. And we're looking for examples of proposals from communities that promote energy efficiency in the buildings that they build, promote alternative energy sources in the buildings that they build or in the communities that they build, and promote and reward places that build in patterns that reduce single occupancy vehicles, promote the principles of sustainable communities. So the first step that we are taking in this year is to apply these more aggressive standards to our discretionary funding opportunities. As we move forward, we're looking at ways in which some of the new programs that HUD is putting forward will embrace the principles of livability. There's a proposal now called the Choice Neighborhoods Program that's being piloted in this year that looks at neighborhood reinvestment for income-diverse neighborhoods and community economic development in urban neighborhoods. And we think that sustainability should be a top priority for those communities, looking at ways in which local businesses might be supported in those neighborhoods, local schools might be supported in those neighborhoods, so that kids can walk to school along safe streets and people can take care of daily errands as part of their daily activities on foot, on bike, or on the way back from a transit trip. This is not to say that we're at the place where all of HUD's funds will be geared toward sustainability, but we're making incremental process to try and find ways in which we can help communities do what we're already hearing people want to do, make it easier for them to make these choices.
Beth, it was directed to DOT.
Yeah, and I understand why Eliza asked the question the way she did. There's a history in the transportation program of recognizing that there's a problem and addressing it by, instead of fixing the problem, throwing a tiny amount of money towards retrofitting the mistakes of the past while we continue to make the mistakes in the future. And I want to assure folks that that is not the path we are choosing at this point. When Secretary LaHood went before the Commerce Committee in the Senate to testify at his confirmation hearing, he laid out five priorities for the department, and those were livability and environmental sustainability, state of good repair, economic competitiveness, and safety. I would argue that really all of them fit within that livability, sustainability umbrella, livability and environmental sustainability. Neighborhoods that have those characteristics also have the strongest economies. They also are safest for all users. We have seen those priorities and livability, amongst ones that are very personally important to the secretary in everything that DOT has produced since then. In terms of our Tiger grants, it's one of our key criteria. In terms of our strategic plan, we have laid that out as one of our top priorities. And as we develop a reauthorization proposal, you will absolutely see those five priorities as the point of our future program. You will also notice that in our budget, we focused some, our budget doesn't focus on a great portion of our program. Most of our program is controlled by the reauthorization process and is directed over a 6-year period through that process. So reauthorization is going to be key to making the overall program focus on the priorities that the secretary has laid out. But in terms of our budget, the small areas where we do have discretion, we have asked to put more of our funds into these efforts to give local communities the keys and the skills they need to figure out what are the costs of good invest, or the benefits of good investments and the costs of bad investments. How do you get the biggest bang for your buck, and how do you ensure that people have transportation choice, housing choice, and destinations close to their homes?
Great. Tim?
Briefly, Derek, I actually did notice in the question when it was asked, they said HUD has done that. Is DOT also going to do that? And they didn't mention EPA, and I think there's a reason for that. So I'll tackle the question from a slightly different angle. I think that in many people's minds, and in fact, EPA's budget should be devoted and always be supporting sustainability and more sustainable communities. And so maybe people don't think that we need to make some change in order to have that happen. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that's the reason why the question wasn't directed at us. And in fact, EPA's mission is to protect human health and the environment, and all of our expenditures should be doing that and are. But I do think that in the context of this question, it's worth saying that EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson often talks about broadening the way we think about environmental protection and what we mean by environmentalism. And that philosophy and that thinking will affect EPA programs and expenditures, and in particular, the sustainable community principles that this partnership works with are becoming embedded in a variety of EPA actions and criteria and guidelines that I will look for opportunities to talk more specifically about on the next question, perhaps.
Well, you very well might. You very well might. I think you're peeking over at my question. So the next question, this actually was the most popular question on the planetizen.com from the readers, and it is directed to you, Tim, about EPA. It says it comes from the Congress for New Urbanism in Chicago, Illinois, and the question asks, EPA stormwater rules in development could unintentionally promote sprawl by focusing on lot scale approaches. Since denser development have lower per capita pollutant loading, can EPA regulations incentivize rather than hinder compact transit-oriented development? And in answering the question, Tim, for some who may not be as technically up on some of the terms used here, could you kind of recast it in layman's terms and then address the question?
Yeah, thanks, Derek. And that is a good question. I think I'd even like to, in order to put the question in some context, take a step back from the specific content of it about stormwater, because it raises a point that's very important for the topic today and for the work that we're doing together with HUD and DOT. And it is the fact that federal actions of many types often do have unintended consequences on how and where development happens at the local level. And that's one of the things that this partnership is thinking about, trying to be very intentional about, and trying to avoid those unintentional bad outcomes that can occur. So, you know, it's something that underpins our whole partnership and this whole conversation is avoiding bad unintentional outcomes. To the specifics of the question, if I can paraphrase it maybe to put it in plainer English for those folks who are less in on stormwater regulations, I think the gist of it is you could ask a philosophical question a couple of ways. Should we, EPA, regulate stormwater runoff the same from a project that is building a redevelopment on an abandoned parking lot that we would a development that's knocking down a pristine forest? And I think philosophically the answer is probably not. We know that we're not going to improve water quality by knocking down more forests and developing more pristine land. So EPA is now working on a national stormwater rulemaking, and that's one of the questions that we're going to try and address through that rulemaking. And I think it's an important one for how cities end up developing and building, that we don't unintentionally incentivize one type of development that we think is contrary to the interests of communities, to water quality improvement, and to building great places that people love to be in. So,
great, thanks. The next question comes from Ginger, and I'm going to address this to Shelley. It kind of is in the vein of a little bit more technical, but I think it touches on an interesting component that was in the Sustainable Communities Grants that I think the viewers would be interested in. The question is, can you all talk a little bit about the way that applicants can gain preferred sustainability status, the potential point system that is linked with HUD's Sustainable Communities Regional Planning Grant Program? Could you talk about that? And you may have something to add, Beth, that concept.
Yeah. So the Secretary Donovan is very interested in trying to smooth the path for communities who want to embrace the livability principles to be able to do that at all stages of their work, from planning to strategy to implementation to management. And often in the federal government, it's very difficult to link together programs very directly, where if you complete one program, you're then put on to the top of the list for an implementation grant, for instance. And as we've gone out and spoken to thousands of people about this new program that we're standing up, people often say, well, it's great that you're giving out grants for planning, both at the local level and at the regional level. We have very few resources to do that, and we need to be able to think in an integrated, comprehensive way about the future of our communities. And that's really the focus of our Sustainable Communities Regional Planning Grant Program. As we developed the criteria for this notice of funds available for this new program, the question kept arising, how can we reward communities that are on the right path, but we just don't have enough funding at this particular moment to be able to give them grants for this regional planning effort. And so we created this new category called the Preferred Sustainability Status. And as we're standing that up, we are proposing that folks who enter into the competition for regional planning grant funding, as their proposal is evaluated, if they reach a certain threshold score in their evaluation, they will receive this preferred sustainability status, whether or not they are ultimately selected for funding. And we think that that status should provide some very specific benefits. First, access to the education, training, networking that we're able to provide for the folks who receive the funding, so that we are opening up the learning and the access to information and best practices to a wider array of communities. Second, we are going to find ways in which, if you're interested in reapplying in a future year, you can preserve some of the work that you've already done this year, and you don't have to keep filling out more paperwork. So we're trying to keep it simple for those who want to apply for the grants in the future. We're also working toward, and this is a very much a work in progress, being able to create incentives in other HUD funds, HUD discretionary funding programs, and hopefully in the future with our colleague agencies, a recognition in their discretionary grant programs that if a community has received preferred sustainability status, they understand these issues. They have embraced our principles of livability, they are ready to implement, and therefore should be recognized in those competitions with a certain sensitivity to that. This is, again, very much a new idea. We'd love to hear people's feedback and comments on that, and also ideas that you might have about how we can make this preferred sustainability status useful and not just, one more thing that doesn't really get you anything.
Anything to add? Or?
I just want to add that it was a really innovative idea on HUD's part. This is always a struggle. You create a new program, and there are communities that have been doing what you focused on for a decade, and there's always this tension of how do you make sure that there is no punishment in having gone ahead. You want to reward those communities that have been trying to do this even before the federal government caught up. And so we are going to constantly look for ways to make sure that those communities that were a little ahead of the curve receive some benefit from that, while at the same time having to balance the need that just because someone may have just started looking at this, we don't want them to be punished
That's
for the
right.
fact that they recognize it's a good priority and they're ready to come to the game now.
Yeah.
And the only thing I would add is that the concept that HUD put in their Sustainable Communities Grant is one that several agencies have reached out to me about, wanting to learn more about it. They're very interested in seeing how it plays out. So I would just second Shelley's request to get feedback from those who are applying for these grants, who are on the ground doing this work, to see what your thoughts are about this, how it could be properly shaped, because I think it has some potential for finding its way in other types of federal programs. The next question is directed to Beth. This is a question that comes from Steve in Mesa, Arizona. The question is, are there any plans to update the requirements of metropolitan planning agencies to include provisions such as housing, urban development, and or economic development plans before they can receive new highway funds?
It's a really good question, and there's a lot of ideas coming from various stakeholders about how to make the metropolitan planning organization process a stronger one. One of the things that we are really excited about in having discretionary dollars is we feel like it creates a kind of healthy competition where folks try to outdo each other in terms of creativity and innovation. And instead of trying to prescribe a way to do this, basically reward those who figure out how to do it well and give technical assistance to others to be able to catch up. And so one of the primary tools we want to look to bring these concepts in is through our discretionary grant programs to reward those who do it. And there will be some who might not try, but they will be taking themselves out of the game in terms of our discretionary grant programs for failing to try. For those who it's a big undertaking, we are proposing to Congress for our fiscal year 11 budget that we be given some grants to help communities that need to build the expertise to be able to do this sort of work. And we're asking for new data to be collected and new types of analyses that they just might not have the technical expertise, they might not have the tools, they might not have the computer programs, they might not have the data. And so as we're telling people that the way to be competitive and get a hold of some discretionary dollars requires a stronger ability to synthesize the various impacts between transportation investments, housing investments, economic development investments, water infrastructure developments. We are going to be there to help them figure out how to do that. And it's certainly something that we are going to be working on with HUD in terms of their regional planning grants to also continue to build up that data, that information, that capacity. And as we do reauthorization, we will look for other ways to strengthen this. It is our goal to make sure that transportation is recognized for what it is. It's a means to an end. It is not an end into itself. Transportation gets people to opportunity. It supports all the things that we have to do as a society. There's no purpose to it except to support all of those things. So we recognize that.
I might add, the Sustainable Communities Regional Planning Grant Program that HUD has a notice out for funding right now, the criteria for that grant program was done in partnership with EPA and DOT. We sat down as a team and crafted the rules for this new program, rather than kind of the usual way, which is one agency puts together the rules and then maybe ask a couple questions of their partners. This is a very different approach. And in many ways, we see this opportunity to seed the kind of long-term planning and strategizing for regions as a step toward helping communities think about the future of the long-range transportation plan, the future of regional water infrastructure planning, air quality planning, all being integrated in some way. Now, whether that then leads to a new set of rules and regulations that govern other federal funding, that's to be seen. And in part, you know, we're hoping that this competition brings forward a set of very diverse examples, places that want to start out thinking about these issues for the very first time, places that have been doing it for a long time, urban places, small town places, rural communities. We're looking at trying to identify a very robust set of examples that can then help a conversation really happen about the future of our metropolitan planning.
Great. This next question actually takes a turn and focuses on a particular set of places and asks a question about what the partnership is doing for them. I'm going to direct it to you first, Tim, because I know you've been thinking about this a bit. The question comes from Al in Youngstown, Ohio. It asks, what place-based policies does the new partnership intend to implement that specifically focus on addressing the unique plight of our nation's older industrial cities?
It's a good question, Al. So I think there is something that underpins that question that's a good way to start, and that is that different communities are in different places in terms of their growth, their vision for their future, the type of help that they need from the federal government. And this question is about a specific group of communities that are transitioning from one type of economy to another. And I think that's a really important thing for us to bear in mind as we do go into communities and try to help them as the federal government, is that there is no one-size-fits-all solution. In answer to his question, I would say that we don't have our 2011 budget has not passed Congress yet, but if all goes well with that, then we do have some resources in our 2011 budget specifically for helping communities like the ones that Al asked about. And I don't know if Beth or Shelley have anything to add to that.
Yeah, I want to point out that one of the first things we did as a partnership was to develop a list of principles that would govern all of our actions. And I've gotten kind of used to rattling them off, but principle four is investing in existing communities first. And one of the reasons I think a lot of these communities struggle is they're built out and there's such a push towards investing in new communities while you let those aging communities just deteriorate. And that is something we want to put an end to. We want to focus on maintaining those communities and strengthening those communities we've already built. So that's one thing that I just wanted to point out, and you'll see it in all of our proposals. And the second thing is at DOT, part of the high-speed rail proposal that is really the most exciting thing that's come out of surface transportation since we put together the interstate transportation system has great opportunity for some of those aging communities, particularly industrial communities that might have had a very large manufacturing sector or particularly auto sector. As we are building this new rail network and investing in transit, frankly, at an unprecedented level, we have the need for new new rail cars and transit cars and street cars, and we are very focused on building those in this country. In the past, the Buy America rules might have been treated with a little more flexibility than they should have, and we are not doing that. So our goal is, as we invest in all of these new rail lines, that the cars and the infrastructure needed for that investment is produced locally. And that can provide a lot of opportunity for those communities that have the workforce and the expertise and the plants and facilities and component part manufacturers, if we can just direct that towards this new line of investment.
Derek, there's one other thing at EPA that I should have mentioned that I'd like to now, if that's okay, yeah. Is that one of our programs is the Brownfields program. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that program is aimed at assessing and help clean up properties that are mildly contaminated or might not even be contaminated but have the perception that they might be. And that program is particularly relevant for these older industrial cities that have a lot of properties that are no longer occupied, that might have minor contamination that need to be returned to productive use. Because we know that contaminated land bleeds into becoming a contaminated economy and prevents new investment and economic development from happening. And one of the changes that EPA is making to its Brownfields program is shifting from a focus on site-by-site looking at things to thinking about brownfields in an area-wide basis, because we know that places don't redevelop just site-by-site. Neighborhoods come back, not just parcels. And so that's a change that EPA is making now, and I think it's very relevant to these communities that were asked about in the question.
And I just have to throw another thing in as we were talking. Thinking about other things, but and one of the first things the president did last year was issue an executive order that basically instructed agencies that we need to be leaders in greening our country. And that has to do with things like building more efficient buildings and using less water and recycling. But one of the things that they asked our partnership to do in collaboration with GSA, which controls the leasing of government buildings and the building of government buildings, is to think about where we place government buildings. And part of our recommendations that have come back to the White House to be utilized in where we place government buildings is to focus again on existing communities, look at the opportunity to utilize formerly developed sites, maybe a brownfield or a former industrial site, but particularly those sites that are close to transit, that are close to amenities, that are in walkable, bikeable communities, so that we don't find ourselves in the odd circumstance that we've seen over the last decade where people build these beautiful LEED certified buildings on the fringes. And while you may have made the building itself much more efficient, everyone who works there or comes there for government service has to drive. And what we found is while the building itself might be a lot more efficient, when you add in all the emissions that come from driving, we actually end up in the hole. We don't want to see that. And so we're focusing on redeveloping it and focusing on those town centers and urban cores, whether in our urban or rural areas. And I think that will have great relevance to some of these older communities that might have felt like they were abandoned even by their post office, even by their federal government.
Mm-hmm. Great. The next question I'm going to direct to Shelley, and it's actually a straightforward one. It comes from Sandy in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and you touched on it early on. The question is, can grant money be made available to support the efforts of cities to adopt smarter zoning codes that permit walkable neighborhoods by right?
Sandy, hello. A little shout out from the White House. absolutely. In the notice of funds available that DOT and HUD collaborated on, we joined up something we call the Challenge Grant Program with a planning function that the Tiger II program has appropriated, and created a pool of funds that communities can seek to do more detailed land use planning, but also to prepare and adopt the codes that would allow sustainable and livable communities to happen as of right without additional permission for each individual project. I think that Secretary Donovan's big priority is to find ways in which we can make it easier for the private sector to be able to invest in these kinds of projects and actually help us implement this big vision. And one of the biggest barriers, which I know you know about, is that often the rules of the game, the local zoning codes, actually prohibit the kind of development that we'd like to see. The mixed use, the higher density housing, or the different housing products, the local services, the local public spaces, the character and quality of communities that we know attracts people to live back in cities or live in suburban communities, live in small towns. And often the zoning codes are one of the key barriers that we hear. And this is a set of funding that can be used specifically to develop new zoning codes.
I think this is an area that's really exciting and a sign of us doing government very differently. One of the things that President Obama has asked of all of our agencies is to look for ways to collaborate across agency. And we have seen agencies that have similar funding pots come together, right, and make them available to the public at the same time so that local jurisdictions aren't constantly trying to figure out which agency to go to and maybe have different rules depending on which agency and different timelines. What's particularly unique about DOT and HUD going forth together with our transportation planning grants and the community challenge planning grants is they are not for the same thing at all, but they are complementary purposes, and we still decided to put them together. Mm-hmm. You know, a transit investment is just never as strong. It doesn't get the ridership if you don't have the land use set up appropriately, if you haven't done the station area planning properly. And yet, because a lot of that is not transportation, we don't fund it through our program. And because these transportation plans and these transit systems aren't housing or economic development specifically, they're not handled at HUD. And we decided that just couldn't stand, didn't make any sense. And so the reason we put them together, even though they don't look like they belong together in terms of the uses of the funds, is because we knew that the best projects to improve livability required an expenditure in both areas. And we wanted those localities to be able to come to one door and ask one time for the funding rather than to go try to figure out different sets of rules and different timelines and different different agencies.
Yeah. Derek, do you mind if I jump in on this one too? Because the topic of codes is one that's really central to a lot of the work that we're focused on.
And I should say that you all are a part of this as well. We talk about the joint NOFA with the two of us, but EPA provides a lot of technical assistance in this area and will be working with our awardees.
Yeah, thanks. So there were a couple of resources that I want to mention for folks who are interested in local codes. One is the fact that EPA has something called the Smart Growth Implementation Assistance Program. We've had that for several years. And the way it works is communities come to us and tell us about a problem that they have trying to build smarter, grow more sustainably. We assemble a team of national experts and EPA folks and go into those communities and work with them. That program is different now because part of the team, we also have HUD and DOT folks going to the communities with us. It's much more effective, and the fact that our three agencies are working together in these communities is really helping a lot of them change their codes. There are also three publications that should be mentioned that are code-focused resources. One is the top 10 changes you can make to suburban codes. Another is focused on the top 10 changes you can make to rural codes. And finally, another recent EPA publication is code changes that you can make to make more energy efficient buildings. Now, all of those are available at the EPA Smart Growth website. That's epa.gov/smartgrowth.
Great. And you all will have an opportunity to promote your websites as well.
Oh, boy.
We just have a couple more questions. This next one kind of dovetails on the last. And I want to start with Tim, but I think that you both may have something to add to it. It comes from Mike in Fort Worth, Texas. It says, in evaluating air quality plans from regions currently in violation of federal standards, would this sustainability partnership place more emphasis on land use strategies that discourage auto-dependent development?
That's a good question. It's a little bit technical for folks who aren't familiar with air quality planning requirements. But the gist of it is, I think I'll paraphrase it, there are a lot of different ways that you can improve air quality. Some of them include more efficient cars or cleaner fuel. Another way that we can improve air quality is by having people travel less. And a lot of research has shown over the years that better land uses, more walkable communities, more transportation choices is a way for people to not have to drive as much. And so the question is, how can that be recognized essentially in federal air quality planning processes? Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, EPA has actually produced something called Taking Credit for Land Use in Your State Implementation Plan, which directly addresses the question that you ask. It's a little bit more complex and not quite as easy to take credit for air quality or emission reductions from land use than it is from, say, a cleaner vehicle fleet or cleaner fuel, but it can be done, and we've gone out and written a guidance document for places that want to do that. And yes, we do want to encourage places that have better land use to get full credit for that under the regulatory processes that we have.
That's great.
I think it just exposes one of the difficulties sometimes in working through formula grant programs to capture these what look like tangential acts, even though they have a direct impact on the effectiveness of your program. At DOT, we have programs that support the building of sidewalks and bike lanes and transit, but it's not really very helpful to have a sidewalk if no matter how far you walk down it, there's nothing to go to. And yet in our program, that's seen as something that has nothing to do with transportation. This administration would disagree with that. And so through our competitive grant programs, we are looking for those projects that do more than just slap down a sidewalk, but actually do it in terms of how they are developing and building and rejuvenating that neighborhood, which means, is it going to be a mixed-use community where there's some place to walk? You know, a friend of mine always says that he considers a neighborhood livable if he can walk to buy a slice of pizza. So has that community changed their land use rules to allow a pizzeria to open within walking distance of that home? And so these are things that they're more complex to put into a program, and formula grant programs aren't quite as nimble as you would like to be able to do that, but we're certainly going to use our competitive grant programs to encourage it.
Great. So this will be the last question. and I want each of you to address it, if you would. The question comes from livablebay.com in Berkeley, California. And they ask, we advocates appreciate the administration's emphasis on livability, sustainability, and transit-oriented development. But what happens when a new administration takes office? In other words, how will these changes be made permanent? So it's a tough question, but a good question is too. What are the partnership and your different agencies doing to embed this new approach into the program so that it lives beyond the life of this administration?
I'm going to start by saying something that might sound a little Debbie Downer, but I'm going to turn it around very quickly.
Okay.
The fact of the matter is, if the public decides that they want to change the direction of their government, they can do that. And that means that new people will come in and want to do different things. And we have to recognize that outside of a monarchy or a dictatorship, that is just the reality. However, what we can do is have a lot of successes on the ground in the very near term so that people can see what it means to do things this way and get excited about it. What we have discovered in terms of those programs that have the most lasting effect is you have some successes early on, you get more people interested and excited about it, and those programs then have a constituency and they do live on. And to the extent that we can show why this works and how it makes communities more competitive and more of a place that people want to come to and live in and raise a family in, the more we're going to see this become a nonpartisan and a kind of a timeless effort.
Well, and I would just also say that so much of what we're finding as we're launching this initiative is that the interest at the local level is overwhelming. There are tremendous number of communities who already are doing things that we would consider aligned with the livability principles that guide our partnership. And we're seeing that from small towns that use their recovery money to rebuild their main street, to large cities that are focusing their housing preservation funding in transit corridors. So we're seeing all kinds of innovation at the local level. I think that part of what we are doing to ensure that this federal attention lasts longer than just one or two administrations is to do what we can to make the rules of the game fair for communities that want to be able to embrace this approach. We're looking at ways in which we can take away the practices that particularly HUD has done that have incentivized development that's inconsistent with this approach and make it easier for sustainable communities to be built in communities by the market, by community leaders. So often that's sort of the unglorious stuff. That's the behind the scenes, rule changing and guidance that we're giving that, you know, most people don't even know is happening.
It's not sexy like a ribbon cutting.
It's not a grant program. But it actually guides how the federal government engages with communities and how they incentivize different approaches to development.
I will echo in slightly different words what both Beth and Shelley have said here, and that is that we are, all three of our agencies, trying to institutionalize the ideas behind this partnership and the principles that underlie the partnership into policies, guidance, criteria, regulations, all of that. As Beth said, governments can and do change hands and priorities and ideas change, but these things are going to be institutionalized and cannot be reversed overnight. And to also paraphrase what they were saying, when government does change hands, ideas that are very good and have wide support often stay in place. And I think that there is wide support for the type of work that we're doing. It's common sense stuff that is good for people and good for the country, and I think much of it is not even controversial and will stand a great chance of staying in place for a long time to come.
And the only thing I would add that you all didn't mention is that in addition to the substance of the policies and regulations you're putting in place, this partnership is also changing the way that these agencies do business. And it's not just the political appointee staff, it's all the way through the career staff mm-hmm. who are collaborating in ways they never did before, which will continue regardless of who's in the Oval Office. And so I think by changing both the substance and the policies, but also the approach, that strengthens the ability for this to have a longer lasting impact. So I want to say, in closing, I want to thank Shelley, Beth, and Tim for joining us today and for taking the time. I thought that the discussion was excellent. I also want to thank PlanetizenPlanetizen.com for partnering with us and all of the readers who submitted questions and voted on the questions. Also those of you who were watching the chat live. If anyone missed a part of the conversation, the entire video event will be posted on whitehouse.gov in the next 24 hours. You can catch it there. Also, please be sure to visit our website for more information on the administration's urban initiatives at www.whitehouse.gov/urban affairs. We also will be posting some of the questions that we didn't get to today. We'll post some of the responses on our website at www.whitehouse.gov/urban affairs, so you can check those out as well. Again, thank you and have a good day.